Hey everybody, and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name's Bina 007, and I'm going to be hosting this episode on the critically acclaimed HBO miniseries Chernobyl and its associated podcast, and of course the real history. The show was created and written by Craig Mazin, directed by Johan Renck, with an all-star cast. And we're going to discuss it in detail. I am joined today, after a long hiatus, by SJ Lee.
Hi, this is SJ Lee, Stephen in real life.
No less welcome and warmly received, it's Dran Snow.
Hey, it's Adam.
And FT Ward.
Hi, Thomas.
And Varley with special guest.
Yeah, she already went back downstairs. Hey, it's Varley on the forums.
Okay, no baby Varley for the main podcast. Boo. So let's go round the table. I don't know if it kind of feels almost dismissive and rude to kind of give this lemon cake ratings or Röntgen ratings or whatever, but oh dear, we
went there. Pills.
We went there. So marks out of five for this show. And also, listeners, obviously we're going to be spoiling this in depth insofar as you can spoil an historic event. So Varley, you want to go first?
Sure. I guess I'd give it like 4.9 iodine pills. It was beautifully shot. It was incredibly acted. The drama was, I mean, already there through history, but the writing was great. And overall, considering the content, it was really enjoyable to watch.
Why are you docking it 0.1?
Oh, God.
I don't know, because really? It wasn't perfect.
Screw you, Varley. I'm giving it 5. I think it was perfect TV.
So the party line is 5.
He has to be a little harsher.
I mean, this
the Central Committee has decided this is 5.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the Soviet Union. You can have any car you want as long as it's red. Thomas, feel free and
I guess better men than me have failed in this spot, but I would give it something like a 4.5, I guess.
You can give it that. The KGB knows.
Yeah. I'll be sent for re-education, I'm sure. But yeah, I thought it was really, really great. Some of the plots I thought spent too much time with it. I got it already, I felt like, after a shorter time, I think. Some of the direction I thought was a little over the top, like just dwelled too long on like the fallout falling from the sky or something. I thought it was... Again, I thought we got it already probably on some of it, but those are very, very minor things. The acting, as Varley said, was great. The writing was very, very good. The production value was really, really good. And just, it's hard to say enjoyable, but it was a really interesting look at kind of localized apocalypse and strains that it put on society. Mm. And it was really, really thought-provoking and interesting.
Everything you said. SJ Lee?
I will obey the party line and give it 5 out of 5. Much for the reasons everyone has already stated, but what I will add is I think the show is incredible at playing with tension, which is really impressive given that, as we've stated, this is a historical event and you can find out what's happening. But even when they do flashbacks to the past, that tension is still incredibly solid and thick. So the musical cues for it, the way the actors like play off each other with glances and tone. Another important aspect for me was the real element of horror that pervades this story, both in just like how scary parts of this is, but also there's been a long-standing fear of nuclear war, right? The big bomb going off. But we haven't dwelled very much as a society on radiation. And almost that's the more horrifying aspect the what radiation does to the human body is nightmarish in ways that are really difficult to put into words. And the fact that they were able to capture so many different elements of it, from you're reading a newspaper and all of a sudden a clump of your hair is just in front of you, to watching a person's body disintegrate due to exposure. And I like the fact that this is essentially like a procedural show. Like, how do we fix this problem? Solution, here's a new problem, solution again, and trying to like keep up with it. But at the same time, you have these different tonal elements woven throughout.
Yeah, and even at the horror level, there's different kinds of horror. There's body shock horror. Mm-hmm. There is the mounting tension. The score has a huge plot to play in that. But there's even sort of Kafka-esque horror, like the conversation with Agasov and the KGB style. So it's working to horrify you on multiple levels, which I think is really interesting. And we can talk more about technically how they achieve that in our detailed review. Okay, so I think I'm hoping we've been joined by Jock. Hey, Jock, do you want to give it a rating out of 5?
Yeah, I'd give it a sort of 5 out of 5. It was never sort of thought of like Chernobyl from a human or a political standpoint.
Agree.
I think they captured that well.
Adam, did you already give a rating? Did I miss you out?
No, I'd go with the same. I'd give it like 5 graphite-tipped control rods out of 5. I really enjoyed this. I was surprised going into this how little I knew about it, as much as I knew just sort of the reference. I mean, I think I knew, you know, there was a disaster in the Soviet Union and, you know, a plant melted down. I'm like, they had a disaster. That was about all I remember. But I think that the choices they made telling this story, the order that they chose to tell things, what they decided to obscure, what they decided to reveal later, like they all worked very well. They had good reasons for doing it. It was just how to tell a gripping story without like having to like really worry about shock value or trying to like get you with a surprise. I mean, they led with, you know, showing our kind of our main character killing himself, right? I felt it was very honest, and I mean, even the changes they made, like from historical, you know, perspective, they, you know, the creator was also, you know, very honest about what they had change and had good reasons for it. And the tension that was built, the characters, the, you know, the elements of horror and suspense, it was just great.
Yeah, all of that and more. I mean, I think if anyone has watched the show but hasn't listened to the accompanying podcast that is available wherever you get your podcasts, it's hosted by Peter Sagal from NPR, and it interviews the showrunner every week after the episode. So obviously they're all out now. And what the showrunner does is tell you why he chose to show what he showed, where he veers from the historical record for dramatic device, why he did that, and, you know, show you lots of books and source materials. And I think they're going to release the full scripts as well so that you can see what was meant to be in but didn't make the final cut. So that it feels like there's a real responsibility and desire for transparency on the part of the showrunner that's really laudable. And I think perhaps reflects the fact that Chernobyl to this day, as we can see from the Russian government reaction, is very controversial as to why it happened and how many people died. And it just feels that I've never seen TV take that historical responsibility so seriously. So I almost just give it like a bonus lemon cake for that, because I think that's really amazing in the modern age to see.
Yeah, looking at his filmography on IMDb, there's nothing there that would suggest that he would create this series. I mean, he's like, he wrote like the Scary Movies and Hangover Part 3 and stuff like that. And it's bizarre to me that he had this in him. I don't know.
Sometimes you gotta, you know, for the paycheck.
I guess so. Yeah. I guess that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
I almost feel like it, in a sense, that's a good thing, because he comes at it just as an interested bystander. And in a sense, he's the ultimate Vocker, right? He's just this guy who goes down the rabbit hole of internet research and Reddit and reads a bunch of books and becomes aspires to be an armchair expert.
Yeah, I guess Scary Movies are horror. But you would think you would have had a horror movie or something more serious, or at least I would have thought a horror movie or something more serious in his writing background or something. It's really impressive that this came from anyone, but as Bina says, he comes off really well, I think, in those podcasts, is just kind of being sincere and honest and wanting to kind of explain this process, which is interesting, almost as the show itself.
Or it tells you something about the age of peak TV, that any schmo can get given a bunch of millions of bucks to make a TV show now. And then the power of the platform, that if HBO decides to make your show, it probably is going to look good because they'll just hire the best people.
You want to hire a bunch of great British actors? Sold.
Yeah. Although
is that an issue, the British accents, for anyone? I've seen comments about that, but to me, it doesn't bother me in the least.
Yeah, as an American, I'm used to all foreigners being denoted as foreigners with a British accent, no matter where they're from.
Yeah. Same. And I mean, he even said, I think on the podcast, he said they kind of specifically, they made that choice to veer away from, like, well, we don't want someone running around with this like cartoonishly Russian accent that might, you know, kind of like take away from the seriousness. So everyone just
John
sort
Malkovich
of
and Billions.
Just talks like they talk. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, Billions, yes.
No one wants John Malkovich and Billions. It's just distracting, isn't it?
Want him when you are watching Rounder.
I think with the show too, there's so many unfamiliar words being put forward that you want it to be as clear and comprehensible as possible. And showing my own like bias, even the names can be tricky. So like having it in clear British accents makes it a lot more digestible for a English speaking audience, I think. Because, you know, Xenon is not a word I know. So to have it spoken clearly in English is helpful.
I agree. There's also some nice regional differences. Like when most people speak in sort of, you know, standard, I guess, sort of semi-posh London accents. And then when you get the miners in, they all have these northern accents. And that was quite a nice touch, I thought, kind of representing sort of geographically where they would have been from in England. So you get that kind of north-south working class bureaucrats kind of divide coming through. Although I do know a lot of people for whom the accents were off-putting. Like one of my cousins, we tend to like the same TV. And she's like, I just can't. There's something about the British accents that's really stopping me from getting into it, which is a dreadful shame. But I guess it is what it is.
And all of the text was Russian. Like, there was, like, I don't think you ever saw anything in English, did you?
And that was a deliberate choice as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though it was all filmed in Lithuania, I think. Okay, so let's get into the meat of the show. And I thought we can do it sort of in the main chunks, which is kind of like what happens at the plant, the immediate sort of cleanup and containment effort, and then the long-term liquidation, as they call it. But before that, I just wanted to take a few moments to focus on the technical aspects, because often I think we at Vok tend to really get into character and sort of how the acting goes. But just a few words on how it's made to speak to that horror, the way it's shot, the way the costumes are done, like all that period work. And for me in particular, I was going through the score this morning to find some intro and outro music. And the score by Hilde Guðnadóttir, I'm definitely pronouncing that wrong, Icelandic composer, I think is stunning. And it really holds up as a score when you listen to it. But is there anything else out of the production and behind the lens stuff that you'll want to call attention to other than writing, character, acting sort of stuff?
I wonder if in the podcast that accompanies the show, which I haven't listened to, they mention it, but it seemed like everything had like a bluish like tint to it. Maybe it was just my TV, but everything seemed kind of like almost monochromatic, but under like a bluish filter. Did anyone else get that? It added something really eerie and like kind of uncanny about
yes.
it, like all the scenes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then they show that one scene of the morning of before the accident, or I guess the day before the accident happens, and it's just brilliant blue skies and everything. And I thought
right,
that
it's full
was really,
color. Right.
Yeah, I thought that was a striking difference to the way the rest of the show is shot.
Mm. I'd highlight the score. I think the score is easy to miss at points, but as I was saying, like I rewatched the finale yesterday. Because it's so good. And I've picked up on just like these little stings and tone and how the music is quietly swelling as disaster looms closer and closer and how it plays off the court scene. Like, I think there's a lot of great moments where the music isn't standing out starkly, but is setting what you're supposed to be feeling or magnifying what you're supposed to be feeling by like an exponential degree.
Well, and that just speaks to what Bina just said about it being a great score. Is the music's supposed to do that. It's supposed to elicit emotion, but, you know, not as much as the acting up front, you know. It's, yeah, like you said, I agree with both of you that the score was just incredibly well done.
Yeah, and I do want to take some time to talk about sort of costume and makeup, just because having spent some time recently at the biggest sort of TV Hollywood costumier called Angels, which actually bizarrely is based in North London, and just seeing these kind of warehouses full of period vintage clothes from all countries, I think there's just something about making it feel convincingly Soviet 1986. Just the way the hair is done with the perms and the flicks and all the smoking, there's a real attention to detail. And I know that none of us really lived in that era, right? So we can't call it out, and they can probably essay it quite quickly. But even things like Komyuk's laboratory, like just some of the instruments in there reminding me of school labs in the 80s. I just feel there's a real beautiful attention to detail that, of course, we know well from HBO, because say what you want about Game of Thrones, the production design is stunning, and that they really do beautifully well. And I want to shout out to all these people, as well as, I guess, the people who did the physical makeup effects of radiation. I mean, what the hell do I know about what it looks like to die bloated of radiation sickness? But it feels like a lot of attention was paid there, and that was suitably horrifying.
I think the first time I really noticed the costumes was in the first episode, when the dude gets out of bed and he's wearing what can only be described as Russian tidy whities, but they looked like the worst, gray, most uncomfortable underwear I have ever seen.
Sandpaper.
One more thing I'll call out, actually, is the set design or the setting. Before the show, I had some prior knowledge of Pripyat and Chernobyl, and like certain parts are scene for scene identical to my memory of what the actual locations look like. Especially when you get that interesting contrast between like the rural area with these kind of poor farmhouses that haven't probably changed much in decades. And then you have the... like the modern town, like Pripyat was supposed to be sort of a model town for like Soviet achievement, which makes this disaster all the more poignant. But it was amazing how spot on it all was.
Yeah, that concrete block architecture, that not quite brutalist, it's just, I guess, proletariat. I don't know how to describe it, but
very much so, yeah.
I mean, at the time, it must have seemed amazing and modern. And as the podcast makes clear, if you were living there, you were one of the lucky ones. There was a Olympic swimming pool in that town. That wasn't normal in Soviet towns. And people ate relatively well and the schools were good. And, and that's what makes it all the more poignant, because there was this kind of Soviet technical utopia. And I think something of that complacency comes through, that when we get into what actually happened on that day, there was a little bit, but the core can't explode. The core doesn't explode. So you didn't see what you thought you saw, as I think Dyatlov brilliantly sums up.
Yeah, it's really weird. If I know I sent you guys a couple links to like Anthony Bourdain's travel to Chernobyl, and I think there's a Jeremy Wade River Monsters where he goes fishing in the Chernobyl lake, and it's all the same. It's just overgrown. You know, it's almost like almost perfect kind of experiment of what happens when humans don't populate an area for 30 years or something, you know?
Yeah, nature's taking it back.
Yeah, but everything's so, like, is going to be radioactive for, like, you know, what'd they say, like 150,000 years? So, I mean, that's just insane.
Because plutonium-241 decays into americanium, which is 432, then it decays into neptunium, which is over 2 million.
Oh, so millions of years.
Good. Excellent. Happy days. Yeah. I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page for this show, and I'm just surprised that the viewers are so low. So, for instance, for the series finale, or actually they don't have the UK figure, so say episode 4, in the US it had 1.193 million viewers, and then in the UK 1.311 million viewers. That feels tiny, and it's kind of surprising to me that actually all the way through the show, the UK's had more viewers than the US. I wonder if it's because maybe we were closer
to
it.
Interesting.
So was it more on our news in the 80s? Because we obviously did get, I mean, not like Finland, but some of the radiation came over, and There were hill sheep in Wales that all got slaughtered because no one was allowed to eat them and stuff. So, I mean, maybe for those of you, we can contrast growing up in the UK, US, Canada, but how much knowledge did you have of this beforehand? Because I was a kid, right? I was 10 years old when this happened, so I remember it on the news, and I vaguely remember some sheep getting killed in Wales. But it never felt like this was a present danger to me, and I didn't really know much about it before the series started at all. I've since read a whole bunch because I've gone down the rabbit hole. But how about you guys? What's your memory of this when it happened?
I didn't realize that it happened in my lifetime. I mean, I it happened in 1986, and I knew like Challenger was 86, right? And so I don't remember that I was like 2 years old, but this, I knew that it had happened. I've seen it in, you know, movies and video games, and, you know, things referenced, but I've just never bothered to actually look into it. And it was interesting talking to people at work who were watching this show. One of the girls who's the same age as me, she was like, what's Chernobyl? Had never heard of it. Which I thought, like, we all thought was kind of stunning.
I wonder if that's why the ratings are so low, because people just haven't heard of it, and therefore...
That was my thinking. Like, yeah. This does not have cultural memory much in the United States, but obviously in Europe, it's a, like, if you were a German school kid who couldn't go outside to play because there was radiation in the air, obviously this will have a less, more lasting legacy the closer you work to it. But, like, to me, I knew what Chernobyl was. And
Yeah, even now, though, like, the exclusion zone, just looking at a map of that, is like still fairly large and fairly close to those in Europe if you're, you know, looking at travel. I just assumed it was like, oh, there's like a 10-mile radius or whatever it is in a nice circle, and that's not it at all.
No. I feel
probably
like
it should be larger.
I feel like even though I was young, I was only 4-ish, I feel like I remember this, but I'm not sure if I remember it, or if like I just get glimpses of TV screens like that were in different shows or something like that. Because I remember the Challenger exploding too, and I vividly remember Chernobyl being reported by Peter Jennings, because that's what the news we'd always watch. But I'm not sure if that's my actual memory or just something that I've seen in other shows since. But I think in America, it was widely publicized because I wasn't born yet when Three Mile Island occurred. But that incident really made us look weak in front of the Soviets, because we had a, you know, nuclear reactor meltdown or something, and you know that made us look stupid and inept. And whereas Chernobyl, that's the main, you know, I think auspices of the Soviet cover-up was that they have to save face in front of the entire world, and you know, which I think is what was his name, Harris's speech
like
at the very. Yeah, at the very last episode, it's like, because it's cheaper, because, you know, this is why we don't do things like the rest of the world does, because, you know, we don't want to let them know that we're saving money, but we can't afford it.
So I guess I'm the oldest here. I was a teenager when Chernobyl happened, and my memory of it is, I guess, through the lens of media in the mid-80s, which is to say, you got your news on the nightly news. So I think if it happened now, it would be an around-the-clock thing,
right?
Even without access, there'd just be people on TV speculating on stuff, but that's not the way that media worked then. You got one newspaper and you watched the news once, and that's how you got the news. So I remember it as being just kind of a slow motion drip of information, and never really kind of grasping exactly what was going on, if that makes sense. I'm old enough to remember Three Mile Island, I guess. I'm from Western Pennsylvania. It happened in Central Pennsylvania, maybe a couple hundred miles, I believe, away from us. And my sister at the time was going to college in Central Pennsylvania. And she was evacuated. And her and one of her housemates came and stayed with us again, because you just, travel was different then. And I think her housemate was from like Boston or something, so she couldn't get home right away. So they, my father drove and picked them up, and they... my father, I don't know if I mentioned this during Wormwood or not, but he was a chemist, and he was in the chemical corps of the Army in the 50s. So he went downstairs, got out his slide rules and protractors and stuff and his manuals, and he plotted fallout from Three Mile Island. This is when I remember this from when I was like 9 years old. And he came upstairs and said we'd probably be okay.
I mean, like, what's
I don't know what he based that on. I have no idea if he was just making shit up.
I mean, the word probably is... Because it's pretty much all or nothing, isn't it, with radiation?
Yeah. Like, well, not exactly, but...
It's like a
I'd love to have someone from Scandinavia on here, because I feel like they were directly impacted
especially
by Chernobyl
for
years and years. So I would really be interested if someone...
Well, it's interesting when you listen to all the media for this show, and Stellan Skarsgård, obviously being Scandinavian, talks a lot about how he experienced it living there And yeah, he said it's really sad. There's this beautiful kind of like lake near my house where you still can't fish now because of it. So I think it was very real and remains very real for people in the Nordic countries. I mean, even now, like you said, looking at the exclusion zone map, I mean, that stops suspiciously close to Kiev, but doesn't encompass it. And you really do wonder whether Kiev should really be in it or not. It's a very oddly done map. Okay, anything more on the technical stuff, or shall we move into the sort of the meat of the show? Nope. Okay. So let's talk about the events of the night and what actually happened with the accident and the test that went wrong and how it's covered in the show, which I guess is mostly in episode one, which is titled with the time at which it happened, 1:23:45, but also finally in episode five, which gives us, I think, the most fictionalized part of this miniseries, which has Legasov in a courtroom, which never really happened, with his red and blue cards, giving us the clearest explanation of why Chernobyl happened that I've ever seen. But let's talk a little bit about the characters in the control room, how you thought the accident was depicted, and whether you could, in 60 seconds, describe to someone why Chernobyl went down, because even now, after episode
just too
five...
too much red.
Yeah, there's too many red cards and not enough blue cards, and then the card switched, and then...
Yeah, I thought the way they did it was great, but I thought even more so, doubling back to showing what happened in the final episode was probably the best decision they made. And I mean, having him give that speech, you know, it was all fictionalized, but kind of based on stuff he put out outside of like that trial setting was a great speech. But yeah, it was fine that it was all kind of not real. But I think that if they had showed this up front, or we had kind of more knowledge of it up front, it would be harder to understand when he's sitting there like, and he's saying, well, oh yeah, no, that's obviously we press the button, everything's fine. Like, everything's fine. And at first you watch it in the first episode, you're like, man, this guy's an asshole. We know this thing melted down. How does he not know? And then once you get through five episodes, you're kind of like, oh, I mean, he was an asshole, but also it sort of makes sense. Like, he was like, no, that's the magic safety button. And the magic safety button makes everything all right.
Yeah, I mean, he took ridiculous risks running the tests and was obviously running the control room with a management style that wasn't conducive to honest communication. But ultimately, the only thing you can say about Dyatlov is he did think there was this switch that was going to work, which I think gave him this false complacency. And then when it didn't work, he obviously couldn't believe what was actually happening. But the test just shouldn't have been run out under those circumstances, which is something that the fictional character of Komyuk identifies very early on, right? That you know, the delay, doing it on the night shift, Kiev asking for power to be at such and such level, the whole thing was just, and it wasn't a test that had ever been run successfully, and the kind of them trying to read the instructions.
And seeing multiple protests during the test.
Like, yeah. Was it the fact that the test had never been run effectively in that reactor? I took it, the way I understood it was that reactor was brought online before all necessary safety testings had occurred, and that they were doing this test to kind of backlog it and check off a box to make sure, to make it look like this reactor had gone through all necessary testing before coming online. Am I misunderstanding that?
No, that's how it's explained in the show.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But it had, I think there is an element to that they don't know that this theory is going to work, that they don't know that there is enough residual power in the turbine to bridge the gap. So there is sort of an experiment in the design process. Because obviously the safety thing to do would be to have the diesel generators running all the time, no matter what. But that means you're burning diesel, which means that's expensive. So they probably wanted to find a way to not
work,
do it.
But they didn't know that it could.
Yeah, exactly.
So on paper, it worked, like communism.
Right. And it was one of those things, too, that, am I right, that they were just doing this as like this is like a last measure, like the power goes out, like we're just making sure that if shit hits the fan, we're okay, sort of thing, like that hopefully that'll never even happen.
By making sure hit the fan.
Yeah.
I think Dyatlov takes the reactor lower. That's from my reading, that he instructed them to take it lower than the specifications of the test ever said absolutely. You should.
Yeah, I mean, he made genuine risky moves that were not in the protocol. If he had followed the parameters of the test,
he didn't understand why the parameters of the test existed, which is a problem, I think, but he ignored them.
And even the parameters seem to be last minute edited, and the guys even running the test were like, which ones do we follow?
The problem is
that I mean, the test basically failed early on, but he said, fuck it.
Yeah, like the test failed immediately.
He just wanted to give his promotion, so...
Yeah, and what happens. You have a system that rewards loyalty rather than expertise, and then you have people who want to get ahead. And for him, it was an acceptable risk because he thought there's a failsafe button and he can see a massive promotion at the end of it, so...
So do you think that was the major... I don't know, Bina, are we going to talk about themes or...
Yes, we are going to talk about themes. Well, but you can go ahead now if you want.
Well, Jock talk. I think he knows actually what he's talking about, maybe unlike the rest of us.
Hey, Jock, tell us how it is, Jock.
From a technical perspective, the two main issues were the use of plutonium-241, which is energy density is just insane. The second is they use regular water instead of heavy water, which acts as a coolant but doesn't absorb neutrons as well. And their computers weren't programmed to keep it below above the minimum level. So it went below a minimum level and a bunch of decay products didn't get absorbed out and effectively acted as modulators, which absorbed neutrons for a certain amount of time until they didn't. And because of that, they were forced to pull out the control rods, which are a much more effective modulator. Then after that, it started to heat up and they tried to use the water to stop it from getting over the threshold of the reactor. And then when they could put the control rods back in, because the water wasn't working, they did that, and that pretty much displaced the water and forced it into a meltdown position. And then it had a sort of change in state-based explosion, where the extremely high temperatures resulted in extremely high volumes and then pressures, which then blew the top of the reactor's steel and rebar just off and caused the entire environment to be covered in decay products such as strontium, cesium, and iodine-131, which is important for humans.
That sounded amazing. I still don't really get it, but I'm very happy that one of us does.
Yeah, I
actually just want to jump in.
There's too much red.
Go for it, FGD.
I want to take issue with how you characterize the accident, Bina, and I think... Part of it, I think one, Dyatlov is reckless and he does do things out of, I think, just like a combination of personal ambition and frustration. But I also think there is a part to play where you have people who are ignorant of how this process actually works in charge of these systems. Right.
So, yeah, but I don't think that's contradicting me, SGD, because I said this is what happens when you have a system where people get jobs based on party loyalty rather than expertise. So
there's
a whole bunch of people who know that how the reactors work and indeed the flaws with them, but none of them are involved in running the plant, sadly.
No, I what I mean is, like, let's take Boris as an example, right? Boris is the, you know, the deputy minister in charge at least of, you know, resources, including power generation or whatever his lofty title is. But he doesn't understand how a nuclear reactor works. So he doesn't understand, like, he wouldn't have understood either that delaying the test for 10 hours means the test is impossible. And we only understand that because we were very well led through that process. Because otherwise, then delay the test 10 hours and carry out the test. And only if someone who is an expert in the field can comment, like, actually, no, that will make the test useless. We have to keep it working until the last minute to make the test valid. Then there's no way to, you can't push back. Like, one of the problems with having generalist leaders and experts under them is who can say the experts are wrong, or if the generalist pushes, like, how do you balance that power dynamic? And I think that gets reflected a lot throughout the show of, like, how do you deal with this problem? It's like, well, I'm the nuclear expert and here's what's going wrong.
So to piggyback on what James said and what I was talking about themes earlier, like, so this kind of situation just screams to me like our current debate on climate change, where you have scientists that study climate telling politicians who don't know, who are not studying climate or just studying their feelings, making decisions about the science that's being produced. Like, did anyone get, like, that overwhelming theme. I mean, there's also, you know, the theme of like corruption within government, ineptitude within government, and like, you know, kind of what is truth and all this.
I don't
this,
even
like...
think it's just government, Matt. I just thought that as strange and unique and crazy as the whole Chernobyl situation was, all of us who work in massive, big, large organizations, so it could be government, it could be private sector, there's a point at which something gets so large that it creates its own latencies and bureaucratic misfires and miscommunications and incentivizations and people who don't really understand the reason why the order was given, Edmure or anyone. And that can lend itself to a situation where someone, even in an earnest way, even if Dyatlov hadn't cared about a promotion, can take a decision for the wrong reasons and miscalculate the risk. So to me, like, and I'll edit this out, someone who works as part of a 90,000 person corporation with lots of different things going on, I was like, this is actually scarily it reminded me a lot of the financial crisis, that you can have a whole bunch of people in banks who are basically not even nefarious when quite earnest, but are being misincentivized, don't really understand the larger plan, and end up doing stuff that leads in some horrible, seemingly ineffable chain reaction in retrospect to cause a blow up, a financial blow up. So it's just the dangers of all complicated, complex structures without alignment of interest and communication of goals. And to me, that's kind of what made this relatable, because in some senses, it's such an unrelatable thing. And I was like, yeah, but we all know, we're all humans. We take stupid decisions and selfish decisions and earnest decisions that end up in the wrong way. And this is how it happens, right?
I really like that point, Bina, and I think you're 100% correct, because I worry that too many people will watch this show and say, like, look at the Soviets being Soviets. This is why communism is bad. But we literally, within this decade...
I mean, it is also why communism is bad.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no. Okay, but
I was going to say that too, but...
Let's be under no illusion.
Okay, but let me finish the point that in this decade, we've had the Fukushima nuclear disaster, which occurred in Japan, in a modern democracy with a technocratic state and all these other benefits.
Which is still occurring.
But a corporate culture in Japan and a societal culture where contradicting your boss and hierarchies are far more entrenched than, say, in the UK corporate culture. Although we still have that problem as well. I think we're on a sliding scale.
I think it'd be easy to make ourselves feel comfortable that,
oh, for sure.
Oh, it's these particular cultures that, like, I live within an hour and a half from a nuclear reactor. I assume, based on everything I know, that it is safe. But, you know, if one day some unimaginable horror happens there and they expose, like, well, you know, the person in charge of the plant was the deputy minister's brother, and that's how he got like, there's always flaws in the system, right? And to pretend like, oh, this is a unique situation, I think it's just that complicated systems are prone to catastrophic failure.
I agree.
And in the case of a nuclear power plant, the consequences are unimaginably horrific.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, a coal plant shutting down.
Right.
Am I the only paranoid motherfucker out there who, as soon as they got into this show, started Googling where's my nearest nuclear reactor, how far away am I? And also, I bought stabilized iodine because I was like, by the time you need it, it's too late. It's too late to get it on Amazon when you need it. Get it now and just keep it in the house.
I've had that shit for years.
Yeah, the sunk cost is so low. So low to just keep it in the house. Why wouldn't
you? We all have bomb shelters in America. I would just say one thing. I don't think it is unique to Soviet Union. If you look at, like, Boeing or something like that, I mean, I think someday someone will make a movie about or a show about Boeing and the corporate culture and how just because someone's an airline executive doesn't mean they're a pilot, doesn't mean they're an aeronautical engineer. Like, all these different people don't understand what the other people are doing exactly, and then you have issues when you're changing or as you said, complicated structures. It's not unique to the Soviet Union, is what I'm saying. Or
and when the external
power.
Force is like a shareholder rather than, you know, the state bureaucracy or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's not different. But Jack,
and when people for the government, they're supposed to be looking at these things, are actually giving the job to Boeing to inspect their own stuff. I mean, there are problems.
Yeah, it's bonkers
here as well. And you know, but communism sucks. So
I think we can we can be even-handed here, and we can talk about now with the accident occurring that there are things within the Soviet in particular structure that made honesty and transparency in corporate communications hard. But then later on, we can talk about how maybe there are aspects of Soviet society that mean that when the crisis occurred, people were more willing to make a sacrifice because they were more community, society minded, and less individualistic than we might be in the West. So I think it's very even, and there are pluses and minuses to any system. And I think certainly a lot of what this show was trying to show is how the Soviets were willing to kind of like buy into the idea that you do things in a Soviet system for society and not for yourself sometimes, mm-hmm. which was continually amazing to me. All these, oh, captain, my captain moments. Yeah. And I was like, surely this can't have happened like this. And then you read Voices for Chernobyl and like, oh, actually it did. It's quite wondrous in a way.
Yeah, there are things that happen in the disaster that have very Soviet flavor. And I think the fact that it was a totalitarian socialist state, things happen that I don't know would happen if a similar disaster happened in the United States or Canada or Britain.
Such as
the robots don't work. The radiation is too extreme and fries the technology. So they say we'll use human robots, right? Like, I don't know if certain countries would go to that conclusion as quickly.
Yeah, I mean, our robots work, right, guys?
They're the best robots. No one makes robots better than us.
It wouldn't happen in the UK, or it certainly would be, it wouldn't happen as quickly, and therefore the consequences would be more grave.
Right.
Other examples? I have a question for you, Stephen, because, you know, you're a student of politics, which is, there is an element to which it's not actually overplayed too much in this particular series, the idea that Chernobyl actually caused the end of the Soviet Union more than Ronald Reagan, because the cleanup bankrupted already very weak finances. The idea that Gorbachev couldn't contain the story fundamentally weakened his grip. The people of the Soviet Union felt, shit, if they lied to us and covered this up, what else have they covered up? How far do you lend that credence?
I think, as is in the epilogue, Mikhail Gorbachev points to Chernobyl as one of the causes for the fall of the Soviet Union. And I think there are parallels in other countries' histories where, like, a particular disaster just becomes a watershed moment that the baseline assumptions about the state get rocked in a fundamental way that is incredibly difficult to repair. And while this may sound funny, I would say something like Watergate is an equivalent for the United States, where faith in government, from my reading of American political history, was fairly strong until the 1970s, even though the Vietnam War obviously eroded that considerably. But I think it is fair to say that it is difficult to sustain belief in a system after a catastrophic failure at its core, because the Soviet Union, sometimes they would use the term scientific socialism, that it is a technocratic state, that we are using science and modernity and like always looking to the future of a more perfect existence through this ideology to guarantee it. And then you have the horror of like the symbol of the modern era, the atomic energy being the cause of the disaster. So I would not at all be surprised, just on the political, like the thought of the people, it having a corrosive effect on the trust of the state. I would also just say that, you know, there was probably a lot of political consequences. Gorbachev in the, you know, moving into the late 1980s was in an increasingly weak position as he tried to implement glasnost and perestroika. And the failure to execute or the failure to run the economy prior, no doubt, you know, made his critics stronger.
Yeah, I think you summed up the impact of Chernobyl very well. There's a really great book on Chernobyl whose details I'll put in the show notes that I read, by a Ukrainian journalist who, his final chapter is actually about all the protests that started happening in Ukraine after Chernobyl and the demonstrations that weakened this idea of a federal Soviet state, and all the journalists who started off covering Chernobyl then became very involved in the freedom movement. So yeah, I think there's a very clear line to maybe if not the complete collapse of the Soviet system, but certainly Ukrainian independence for sure.
Yeah, because Ukraine, there was a thought that the Soviet Union could survive some of the breakup. But as soon as Ukraine declared independence, I think a lot of senior leadership, I think Gorbachev was quoted as saying, now it's all over. Because Ukraine and Russia obviously have a very deep and complicated connection with each other, but its separation was fundamental.
Well, wasn't the Ukraine then like the breadbasket of all Russia and the, you know, the Iron Curtain states?
my knowledge of its economics is limited.
But yeah, I think
Stalin wasn't starving them all to death, sure.
Yeah.
That is often forgotten is Ukraine was an incredible industrial heartland too, which, like, if you look at Eastern Ukraine and the area of Russia beside it, like, that's kind of their big and a big industrial area. So if you have this huge command economy where all of a sudden your ball bearing factories is on the other side of the border, like, this is a problem for just like
the cohesiveness. Plus it has Crimea, right? It has the port, so Ukraine is deeply important. The book I was referencing, which is excellent by the way, is called Chernobyl: History of a Tragedy by Serhiy Plokhy. The surname is spelled Plokhy, a really good summary of the accident, but especially the political fallout afterwards. Okay, Stephen, thank you very much for participating as far as you could. It's been great having you on. Sorry you have to go. But
I will just add one thing, because Matt nudged me, and I want to emphasize it again, is I think radiation is so scary, and I think we've gone a little bit accustomed to it. Like, we know not to be afraid of x-rays or things like that, you know, as long as you don't get them too often. But I'm amazed it's not an idea that hasn't been explored more. And when it is explored, it's like the bizarre super science fiction mutants kind of thing. Like, just the impact of what a radiation does. And there's some really poignant moments, like Dyatlov is arguing it's perfectly safe as thousands of units of radiation pour into the atmosphere. And then he vomits on the table because he has radiation poisoning. Or the firefighter who touches the graphite for a second and a minute later, his hand is just weeping blood. Or, of course, what happens with the firefighter who has his wife and they're expecting the child. Like, that's, he doesn't look human at the end of his life. And it's just pouring out. Like, that's the crazy part.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like an invisible, like, this malevolent, like, you know, being that will, you know, even small amounts, they're like, well, we already will get cancer now. We'll die, that's what we'll die of, but not for maybe, you know, 20 years. And that's just from, like, you know, being outside for 15 minutes. It's like, you know, how can you fight this thing? You really can't. It's yeah. And what it does to you is, oh, God damn it.
You know, buy a stabilized iodine, kids.
But that only works for what Jock said. The iodine.
I feel like Jock needs to tell us about alpha, beta, and gamma rays at some point. Learn us about why iodine isn't going to be helpful.
Iodine is always helpful, even if there's no radiation. The main reason I need iodine for the radiation stuff is because iodine-131 gets replaces the iodine in your body. And iodine is very important to your body, and iodine deficiency is the main cause of learning disabilities. So you really don't want to absorb iodine in your neurochemistry if it's an isotope that's radioactive, because it'll just really mess with your brain. And if you want to find a silver lining from the disaster, it's the mass adoption of iodine throughout Ukraine, because it will probably have prevented a lot of learning disabilities. If you use IQs as a measure of learning disabilities at aggregate, Ukraine is about 5 points higher than even places like Ireland, thanks to this. So you should probably take iodine if you want to, like, prevent learning disabilities, even though you're likely to get all you need in your diet, like, just in case.
Great. Yeah. Well, we'll take this opportunity to say bye to SGD. Bye.
Have a great weekend. I'm off to go buy my iodine and drive past a nuclear power plant.
We should set up a subscription service for iodine.
Yeah.
Your million-dollar idea.
Hashtag VocMed.
As for radiation, the only thing which will stop gamma rays would be lead, and you do not want lead for the same reason that replaces calcium in, like, your brain and your bones and stuff, and you don't want anything similar to calcium near you, so avoid, like, protecting yourself from gamma rays, because lead's worse. Alpha and beta rays really don't pass through things easily, so, like, anything will really stop them, so, like, cloves is the best protection against those radiations.
Isn't that why the dust was so bad, though? Because then you end up breathing it in or something.
You've got nothing to stop from that. So just any sort of fabric mask or anything to stop getting your lungs would save you from that.
So we've talked a bit about the accident. Do you want to talk about how the actual accident is portrayed on the show or anything more about the immediate psychological and practical response to that, guys?
It's just terrifying. I really like the way they did break it up as to the aftermath and then put the actual accident itself at the end when you have all that context. I thought that was a brilliant decision.
I like how it increased the tension where it's like they just keep on finding band-aids. It's like, okay, well, we can muster, you know, every piece of concrete in the entire Soviet Union, and how much time does that buy us? Oh, like 10 days. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, so let's maybe move into the events of episode 2, which is called Please Remain Calm, where effectively you've got Lugarsov, who is our protagonist, I guess, the guy we sympathize with, going to Moscow, trying to convince Gorbachev that maybe he shouldn't believe everything he's being told, and this is more serious. And we get introduced to Shcherbina, played by Stellan Skarsgård, who starts off as a skeptic, but then becomes this real ally of Lugarsov. And there's that really scary scene when they're flying to the plant in a helicopter, and Shcherbina saying to the pilot, fly over it because I want to have a look. And Lugarsov saying, if you fly over it, we're all dead. Please do not. And you just don't know whether the helicopter pilot's going to, who's going to obey. And then Lugarsov starts his, what we now think is probably futile attempt to suppress the fire with sand and boron drops. And Pripyat is finally evacuated, just way too late, but it is. And then also we have at the end the idea that they need to go underwater and effectively, is it just close off some valves to stop a further explosion that would make this, you know, a nuclear problem that would affect the whole of Europe? And they
I thought it was open to cool it.
Yeah, right?
And then they get these three volunteers who agree to go underneath and do this, even though actually they're not professional divers, and shockingly they all survive, right? So this is the kind of let's just try different things kind of phase of things. And I think we can even get into that a little bit in episode 3, Open Wide, O Earth, where they basically go and get a whole bunch of coal miners and ask them to sort of tunnel underneath. And effectively, what you're trying to do is prevent the core from melting down through the concrete sort of base and get even more insane in terms of what's going on. And they just get these miners who are sort of bollock naked but wearing their hats.
Oh, they're the best characters, right?
They are the best characters. That, I mean, they, honestly,
they're dwarves, right?
It's just great. Because the reason being that the main miner, like the key character there, just gives zero fucks about his superiors. When they come to him, it's like, we'll do it because it's the right thing to do, not because you're asking us to do it, because we know you guys are just self-interested shitheads. And we know that this protective clothing you're giving us is pointless, otherwise you would be wearing it. And it's really hot in there, so we're going to go bollock naked. But just because you are our superiors and slightly to take the piss out of you, we're going to keep wearing our hats. Now fuck off and let us get on with our job. And I just love that. But that is all part of the second phase, right, which is the sort of immediate dealing with it in containment. So how, any thoughts on this? How did you find it? I mean, I've obviously talked about the characters I love best. There are therefore the two "Oh Captain, My Captain" moments when the three underwater divers volunteer and then when the miners volunteer, which I found very moving.
Yeah, I really liked it, like the ultimate sanction of the Soviet Union. Like, we're going to shoot you, we're going to throw you out of this helicopter, we're going to send you to Siberia or whatever. It's meaningless at this point because your options are that or a horrible, horrible death. So people will have to do things not because they're forced or coerced to, but because they ultimately choose to do these things. And it's really interesting for me to watch that.
And I think there was a line, maybe in one of the later episodes, it's like, you know what all your grandstanding does when the bullet hits the back of your head? Nothing. And it's just like, but for those divers, it's like, yeah, well, shoot in the fucking head then. Like, or, you know, for anyone that's forced to do it, just like, yeah, shoot me rather than let me melt, like, in a bed. Like, and I was so surprised in the last episode to find out that the divers were all okay.
I liked Shcherbina's speech a lot. I thought where she's kind of said that, you know, we're Russians, we suffer. Every generation has their suffering to do, and this is going to be ours.
Yeah. Although I think the best Shabina quote of all is when Lugashev has that aforementioned run-in with the head of the KGB, and he's and Lugashev's like, "How do you think that went?" And he was like, "Well, you came off as a naive idiot, and naive idiots are not a threat." Shabina is definitely the cool person, the coolest person in the show. Did you find it a bit too, oh, Captain, my Captain? Which of the bits you thought took too long, Thomas, when you were talking about parts of the show just lingering too much?
So, like, in the first episode, when they're on the bridge and stuff, and they're just, like, camera's just, like, on the fallout or whatever, there were just moments and storylines where I felt like it was a little excessive. And it didn't trust the audience enough, I guess, to kind of understand it without. And it's complex stuff, so, I give the filmmakers the benefit of the doubt. But there are times where I think it's a little too hand-holdy.
Mm.
And maybe that's just the nature of the material.
But I think it needs to be, because I think, like, how do you know which bits of which audience? Like, even for me, like, now I realize what I'm describing it, there are things I still am not utterly 100% on. I found the brilliant quote where Lugashev is speaking to Gorbachev and he says to him, "We are asking for your permission to kill three men." And Gorbachev says, "Well, all victories inevitably come at a cost." I think your point earlier about totalitarian societies having a, I would hope, a higher threshold for sacrificing people is there.
I mean, this is in the middle of the Afghanistan war. This is in the middle of, you know, Star Wars and kind of Reagan kind of upping the ante on arms race. And I think just for me, it's just all of those things. It's not just Chernobyl that ends the Soviet Union. It's just plus the weight of mismanaging the economy for decades.
Mm.
So... But I don't know. I think Gorbachev comes off pretty well here. I'm kind of a fan of his management style, at least in this series.
If anything, I think the show was quite kind to Gorbachev. I mean, I studied Gorbachev in A-level history and at university, and I think that he definitely did not cooperate with international agencies as he should have, and therefore put lives at risk of radiation in other parts of Europe. And even if you read his autobiography, which I have done, he's very equivocal about this period. And what I was thinking when I was watching this show and remembering all that is that Gorbachev is a little bit like Nelson Mandela. There are some of these foreign leaders that in the West we think of as really
good guys
because they enabled us to resolve something. Like, let's resolve the Cold War, let's resolve apartheid. And you forget that for their own people, they can be horrific. I'm surprised you say Gorbachev came off well. I thought he came off as weak, vacillating, and basically equivocal. But maybe that's the best one can hope for.
Well, I think that's just perspective too, right? I mean, you know, one country's freedom fighters is you know, another country's terrorist.
Well,
so,
indeed.
You know, I think what you just said, Bina, is true about Gorbachev, because I'd never studied him. We knew that, you know, he made he opened up Russia through Glasnost and Perestroika and wanted to make it more open, and then just got away from him. But, you know, overall, like, you know, he signed the SALT II treaties, and, you know, he was a good guy, you know, and his predecessor, the Russian Yeltsin, was, you know, even better, you know, just a good friend of America. But it's like, I guess for people that really study him, it's much different. And I've actually heard that he was actually quite brutal to, you know, to get up to his position of power.
Yeah.
I would just say I felt like he kind of delegated well here, and he kind of provided resources, pretty much everything they asked for within the structures that he couldn't fully humiliate the nation for political reasons as well as for just practical reasons. So again, I have a mixed feeling about him historically, but here I thought he kind of was exasperated, which you would expect him to be, and kind of stepped up for the most part.
Indeed. Okay, so then after we get to the immediate cleanup, which we've apparently sacrificed three miners, but miraculously they survive, we know that the firefighters are going to do this amazing, not firefighters, the miners are going to do this thing. History suggests that that may also not have been needed, just as the human robots might, you know, blah, 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 might not have made, or, sorry, the sand and boron drop might not have made much of a difference. And then we get to the cleanup. So that felt to me like episode 4 was much calmer, and it was totally different in focus. And it's these poor schmo soldiers who were like killing pets in the exclusion zone. I actually found that change of pace a little bit jarring. How did you guys find that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was definitely
just like they've shown us the sacrifice of lives, I think, in the episodes leading up to that, the miners, everyone else. And this was sort of the sacrifice of spirit, I guess. I thought it was, you know, and there were thousands of people that had to go around doing this, right? But they just kind of
hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, wasn't it 600,000 people were involved in the
liquidators or whatever? Yeah,
yeah, it's right. Bonkers.
They got an extra 600 rubles at the end. So.
Jesus.
And all the free vodka.
I mean, that's the thing of Russia through history, isn't it? They can just throw manpower at the problem. Yeah. Well, they choose to, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. They can kill their own people, throw their own people at problems. Yeah, that's one of their best exports.
Yeah, I thought the change in pace, where before it's like second by second, minute by minute, like in 48 hours, it's going to completely melt down to the groundwater and stuff. And then kind of get, I think it's like a 5 months later or something, and just does kind of change for the remainder. And I personally wouldn't have minded like another episode or something about maybe the construction of the sarcophagus or something. Or I could have even used a little bit more of the cleanup afterwards. But I thought this was an effective episode with the young soldier from Dunkirk and those kind of three liquidators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it did bring it back to, again, Afghanistan, I think, to let you know that's concurrent with this.
Yeah, I think that came across really strongly, this idea that if you're some low-level grunt in the Soviet army, this is just another shit job in a succession of shit jobs. In fact, it might even be better because, yes, you're getting low-level radiation, but, hey, you have a bunch of Afghani Civil War guys trying to kill you. So, I mean... I think they get along some of that battle-hardened cynicism from the older guys who are sort of inducting this young kid into what they're doing very well. There's some good gallows humor in this episode, at least, to contrast with Paul Ludmilla giving birth to the you know, her baby who dies. So
yeah. Yeah, I don't mind it because I think it's almost deliberate as a part of trying to show that we've seen like the hierarchy of the Russian society and how each level has dealt with this so far. And this was just kind of a vignette into a novella into the soldier. You know, we've seen the miner, the industrialists, we've seen the scientists, we've seen the bureaucracy ruling party. Now we get to see the, like you said, the grunt soldiers just moving from one job to another and just doing as they're told. But still having a weird sense of their own humanity, because that guy's like, don't shoot him and let him suffer. You want to shoot him to kill them. And, you know, if I catch you doing that, I'll hurt you, you know.
The other thing in this episode, episode four, is that at that point, Lugasov is very much against Komyuk. Like, Komyuk has discovered that there was a fault, an accident at the Leningrad power plant in 75, that there's a known fault with the RBMK reactors. And she wants Lugasov to use his testimony at the IAEA in Vienna to expose what happened. And at this point, he's still the Soviet bureaucrat who refuses to do so, which I kind of like. I think that's a human reaction. I like that he wasn't straightforwardly and immediately a hero.
Yeah, it would have been hard to change that, though. That's what really happened, right? He kind of told some truths and he told some lies in Vienna. So I'm surprised they didn't actually show any of that, I guess. But
I wonder if that's a dramatic reason. Like, they wanted to keep it all very much focused in Soviet Union, I guess. And then as we go into the final episode, we just get effectively to the courtroom drama, which, I mean, there was a court case and Dyatlov, Brukhanov and Fomin were put on trial, and that's all very accurate. But in reality, Shabina and Lugasov weren't there, but they use it as a chance for Lugasov to sort of expiate, to tell what really happened there, and to break out the information. And then, bizarrely, the KGB not to prosecute him, just to let him live out his final days until he realizes that the radiation poisoning is really overtaking him and commits suicide.
I did enjoy how everyone's scared to death of this radiation while just chain-smoking cigarettes.
That's accurate. Yeah, I thought the courtroom scene, though completely fabricated, was really effective in explaining it, at least as I understand it from reading about it. It kind of reinforced everything that I had read. And I thought Jared Harris's performance is really good as in that moment. And I think him and Shcherbina's relationship is really kind of interesting, the way it's kind of evolved through the five episodes. And end up really liking them both, I think.
Yeah, I think Jared Harris has a quality about him as an actor where you really sympathise with him, and he portrays that sort of decent guy caught in a horrible situation really well. He did so also in Mad Men with the same ultimate fate, and I think he's a really tremendous actor, and I hope this show, the critical acclaim of this show, much like Mad Men, gives him a platform. Whereas I think Emily Watson is already a great actress and everyone knows it, and she lives for these sorts of brilliant character-driven roles.
Who's better in The Terror, right. I think.
So. Yeah, no, but he does have like something very sympathetic about his face, or it's something that he does with like when he, I don't know, there's some way he emotes using almost the wrinkles of his eyes that can make you very sympathetic to him. Or like in The Terror, where he's just, you know, a complete alcoholic, that he somehow transforms them into, you know, that drying out process of pain and like, you know, kind of some kind of foreknowledge and frustration. I don't know. He's a very good actor.
Yeah, agree. It's just a beautifully put together show. And I think the courtroom drama, I know it didn't happen in reality, but I think we needed that as viewers. We needed the catharsis of seeing him have his moment of truth. We needed to get the explanation clear in our heads.
Did it not happen at all? Like, not in a courtroom setting, but in front of kind of like the...
No, I mean, he's not at the courtroom. It's a show trial. So there's no big moment of catharsis. And he commits suicide, and he has committed his diaries or interpretation of events to cassette tape, which were then found in his apartment. So that's a lot of how the real information came out. But it wasn't this big one grandstanding moment at all.
Right. Because I think they said he had spent months. He tried to get the Russian scientific community kind of on board to explain this to others. And, you know, they just sort of, a lot of them towed the party line. And then when he committed suicide, as like still in the public eyes, this like hero of the Soviet Union, like they all had to pay attention.
Yeah.
So, I said earlier, like, I kind of got the theme that we're being beat over the head with climate change and how, and I wonder what, and if it's mentioned in the podcast, please let me know, what precipitated releasing this series right now, not only in this political climate, which I feel like there's direct comparisons to in the show as well, but also in regards to, like, climate change and our current just humans being able to poison our planet completely.
Well, I think he said that, I mean, this was just a very important story to him once he got into it. But I mean, he made the point several places that, like, he's not trying to sound the alarm and, like, make people be afraid of, like, our current nuclear power or anything. But that it's something that we need to pay attention to and understand the risks of and the power that is there. But it's not like, you know, we need to go. He's not, like, advocating that we, like, shut down all of our nuclear plants because they're going to melt down or something crazy like that.
To me, you know what, to me, Vali, I totally get the whole climate change, man versus nature thing, but the theme that came out to me again and again, and maybe it's because that's how Lugasov starts and finishes the series, is the idea of if you repeat the lie often enough, you lose sight of what the truth actually is. And that resonated to me, not just in the superficial fake news environment that we live in, but just the idea of when we live in this new world of social media, and, you know, we're now in a world where anyone can take a picture of you or a clip of your audio and fake it that you're saying anything, right, or doing anything that, and, you know, we have a decline of investment in proper investigative journalism because newspapers can't make money. This idea that as bad as 1986 was in this case, in 1986, we still had the evening news and we still had daily newspapers that had proper, you know, news desks. And as much as SJD might have said that Watergate fundamentally undermined our faith in government, but in 1986, for most of my childhood and up until very recently, there was a real faith in news media and news outlets and the elections were not interfered with. And I just felt like this seemed very timely to me just because it really made us look at, you can live in this Kafkaesque world of cognitive dissonance where there's the truth and there's another truth and then there's lies.
Alternative facts.
Yeah, but it's ultimately so wearying to live in that gray area. And that, I mean, far be it for me to have the audacity to try and sort of explain why Lugasov commits suicide, but I think you can just see it in Jared Harris's performance, this complete exhaustion of living the lie and the truth simultaneously. And I think that's a real warning for all of us.
Yeah, for me as well. I think it's that orthodoxy where you can't challenge the quote truth, unquote. there's a established set of facts and that there's no challenging that. And I think that's the issue. And that's, I think, limited to climate change, but it's a broader issue for me than that.
Yeah, there's. I don't know who directly did the quote, but I know Neil deGrasse Tyson posted a lot on his social media. It's that science doesn't care what you believe in.
Yeah, that's here as well. There's a quote like that. And it's like the truth is just waiting for you. It doesn't care what you say or do. It's still going to be the truth. And I wish I had his exact line, but it's better written than that.
You're right, Bina. It's just the frustration that no matter how much he talks, no matter how much he tries to get information out, it can be suppressed, and it can be almost as if he was erased. Like that, you know, everything that he did and everything that he suffered for can effectively be, you know, amounted to nothing because, you know, the state can just erase him and everything he said and make sure that, you know, anything that he said, you know, will not be on a record, will not be disseminated, will not be, you know, brought up in the literature. And, you know, one of the scenes that really struck me was the library scene where it's like, why would you have a library where there's like the restricted section in Harry Potter? People are just going to want to know what's in the restricted section, right?
But I think it is interesting, right? There are a lot of people associated with Chernobyl who end up having real mental health issues or committing suicide. And I think this idea of living within fake narratives is ultimately damaging to yourself. I mean, Nikolai Foeman killed himself, didn't he? He had a nervous breakdown. I think there was a lot of guilt about sending people out of the reactor control room to look at stuff that killed them and then not believing them when they came back. But he had a really torrid time of it, even before the trial, let alone afterwards.
Didn't he get a job in nuclear engineering afterwards, like after he got out of prison? They gave him a job back.
No, I think that was Brukhanov. So Foeman, before the trial, had a mental breakdown and tried to commit suicide.
Yeah, I thought Paul Ritter was excellent. His dialogue, it's kind of an unpleasant person to play, but he's also a victim, and you can kind of see his frustrations at times where there's no point to anything he does after this. He's both a scapegoat and he's both guilty and a scapegoat.
Yeah, so Brukhanov was sentenced to 10 years in jail, but only survives. I think he may be the one who went on to work again.
So I don't know that I've seen the actor Con O'Neill, who played him, in anything, but how is he not like one of the best character actors like ever? Like, where's he been?
What, the guy playing Brukhanov or the...
Yeah.
Yeah. He's he's a bit more familiar to those of us who are in watch British TV, I would say.
Luckies.
I know.
That voice, though, is just fantastic. I mean...
Yeah, and he does an awful lot of theatre as well, so I think he's more a thespian, but yeah. It's kind of just weird they're watching this because a lot of the actors are people that you are kind of unexpected. So, but even like, you know, in the trials, seeing Roose Bolton show up. And
Roose Bolton, Maester Llewellyn, Rory Cassell, Lord Commander.
Yeah.
Lord Commander's
sorry,
in there?
Did I say Llewellyn?
Yeah.
What's that?
Yes, you did.
Lord Commander's in there?
Yeah, he's one of the miners.
Oh, wow.
And then we had... Oh, shit.
Pip is in there. He shoots the cow. Mm. I don't think that's how a cow would die if you shot it with a 9mm, but...
The guy playing the Outlaw was Harry
Immersion
Potter's
ruined.
Uncle, wasn't he? The evil uncle in Harry Potter. So he always plays dodgy characters. I just felt they could have found someone to play Gorbachev who looked more like Gorbachev. That was my only real criticism.
Right.
He looks like Alan Alda, I thought.
Yes.
Like, they should have just got Alan Alda to play, but I guess he's probably too old at this point.
How did you guys feel about the creation of the character of Komiuk as this sort of composite scientist who is the do-gooding champion of truth? A little bit too pure than pure, or...?
Yeah, I liked her first episode a lot, where she just kind of figures it out. But after that, I thought she was a bit too Mary Sue. I don't know. Is that going to get me in trouble for saying that?
But no, but I think you're right. She was just too... She was like the conscience of everyone. Yeah. And I think to me, it was just like you made a composite scientist and you made her a woman because there weren't enough strong women in this because basically all the guys doing stuff were men. So it felt a little bit fake.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's certain spots in history where it's just like, I'm sorry, but there were no females in the room. Like,
it is what it is.
I'm guessing the Russian Politburo was like, masculine.
I think they did have scientists and doctors and stuff. Where
there were a lot of female scientists and doctors in the Soviet Union. It was kind of like the one exception. I mean, I think he said almost half the doctors in the Soviet Union were female at one point.
Well, that's one of the, you could quote, benefits of the communist system is the same thing happened down in Cuba, where it wasn't such a patriarchal, like, profession. It was very inclusive, and because everyone got more or less the same education, you know, they were able to take people that showed promise, whether they're male or female, and promote them into those positions.
Yeah, when you look at the rise in literacy rates after the Russian Revolution for both men and women, but particularly for women, it's just astonishing. And, you know, the whole kind of ideology behind the communist state of, you know, marriage is like a bourgeois institution, so it's easy to divorce. Women have control over their reproductive systems. I mean, a lot of that stuff is very progressive and great, you know, and was very positive for women who wanted to be in science in particular. So credit where it's due. Have we got anything
else
to say?
Anything?
Or are we good to go?
Can I talk about some conspiracy theories?
Have at it, Vali, have at it.
All right. So this is very 1,000-foot view of all of these, but these are some of the ones that I picked up through a rabbit hole that I fell off of from Bina mentioned the Voices of Chernobyl. One section by Szymanski said that there may have been government pre-knowledge of the event and that it was used to study radiation effects. And this was because the event actually occurred deep inside the Earth itself. So I didn't really read much more, but I'm thinking like a Cthulhu kind of deep ones, old ones kind of connection there.
I'm assuming
the world's most expensive experiment. I mean,
yeah,
it was.
So and he goes on to say, of course, that UFOs were involved. But in this case, eyewitnesses report the UFOs actually helping out and making sure it wasn't a global disaster, because they would later show up in 1989 to respond to a smoking reactor that then stopped smoking. So we have UFO firefighters for Chernobyl. A documentary called Russian Woodpecker outlines the Duga 3 radio system, which in 1986 was within the exclusion zone of Chernobyl and was built to defend against missile launches in a technology called over-the-horizon radio something or others. Anyway, it screwed up radio signals like a solar flare would, and because it cost $7 billion and didn't work, the theory is that the Russian government itself caused the disaster to kind of swipe that mistake under the rug.
Have you ever seen that thing?
It's weird looking.
It's huge. It's insane.
There was an episode on the Science Channel called Mysteries of the Abandoned that outlines the CIA sabotaging Chernobyl, in fact, to sabotage the Duga 3 radio system instead. So
you know what the sad fact is, that we're about to get the Russian version of this Chernobyl miniseries, and it probably is going to accuse like CIA malfeasance on causing the accident or some shit.
Yeah, by all accounts, that's basically what Putin wants, is like the Americans caused this somehow.
Yeah,
and it wasn't.
So it's ironic, right? This series that's all about, you know, lies versus the truth and establishing the narrative is now going to prompt a massive counter propaganda effort. Nothing changes. It's profound. Depressing to me.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that this show was extremely generous to the, you know, the Russian and, you know, to the people, but not the government, which, I mean,
yeah, which is the perfect balance.
Yeah, the Soviet Union died, but, you know, I mean, I know Putin's trying to bring it back and shit. Come on, man.
Yeah. Okay, so only a couple more.
Oh, there's more?
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm not done. Okay. The KGB, during the time, especially the Three Mile Island incident, nuclear power was a little suspect. So the KGB, with the thoughts that Europe was debating whether or not to build their own power stations, caused this disaster to make sure the European bloc would be dependent on Russian pipelines and Russian energy for the foreseeable future, and they would corner the European energy market. All right, how about that? There is in Greece a small island named Gvados, where there is a commune of survivors, where it is believed that they are studying immortality based on radiation exposure. And finally, Chernobyl in Russian loosely translates to wormwood. So this was prophesied in the Bible.
That one, I believe. That one.
Hold on.
Revelations.
Where? Yep. In Revelations, it says, quote, "The third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. And it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood. And many men passed of the waters because they were made bitter." And the memorial to the first responders who fought the fires at Chernobyl is a statue of an angel blowing a trumpet. And that's my conspiracy theory roundup.
Okay. Chuck, do you want to... I don't think any of those things caused it, but I like the idea that the Wormwood Revelations theory leads us into the Good Omens VOC that will be recorded in an hour.
I love that show. I wish I could participate, but I have to...
Yeah. Is that in like an hour?
Yeah, an hour and a quarter.
Do we want to talk about at all like docudrama versus reality, especially in a show that is kind of about the truth and kind of the, or I guess we've kind of tangentially touched on this along the way, but.
Yeah, we can do. I mean, all I would say is that I read even now, like on Twitter, if you hashtag Chernobyl and you get to all these like pathetic criticisms of
yeah, what didn't happen in reality. Yeah, that seems to be the backlash, right?
And it's like, we know it didn't happen in reality and the showrunner told us it didn't happen in reality and he gave us 80 links to what did happen in reality. But if you just watch a pure documentary. Watch a documentary.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
he was very, very honest about that stuff.
Yeah, and I think the last episode, the last part with the text and everything was very helpful to distinguish what was fictionalized and what compared to what actually happened or what was actually believed to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I just thought maybe we should touch on that topic for a few seconds.
Okay, boys and girls, that's about it for our VOC episode on HBO's Chernobyl, a show that we all thought had great merit, beautiful content, beautifully produced, with a real eye on explaining to us what was and wasn't reality, which is to be applauded. We really hope that if you haven't watched it already, this inspires you to watch it. And if you have watched it, maybe to check out the podcast and some of the books that we've mentioned in the show that really give extra context and richness to your understanding of the events. So I have been Bina 007. I want to thank Thomas, Jock, Adam, Stephen from earlier, and Matt for joining me. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Bina.
Thank you.
And I want to close out by saying that you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, but we're also newly on Spotify. So if you like listening to stuff on Spotify, you can check us out there. And if not, you can get involved by following us on Twitter, Instagram, by looking for VOC Podcast, or by joining the the forums of a podcast of Ice and Fire. Thank you all for listening and goodbye. Bye, everyone.
Happy Father's Day.
Bye.
Happy Father's Day. Yo, yo. Hey, yo.
Hey.
Hello.
Long time no VOC, SJ Lee.
It's been a while. It's been a minute.
Yeah. It's awesome to have you back. Vali, is the baby on?
Hold on. We're trying to make her make a noise.
Just pinch them. That's how I usually do.
I don't want to pinch them.
I don't think you should wake your baby up deliberately to make a noise.
No, she's awake. She's just not making any noise.
Are you sure she's yours? I mean, like, genetically.
Boom.
No, it's still the alleged father.
Oh, and that's how we do it on Valk. Okay.
Is the hair the right color?
Yeah. And see the strong.
That's all you would know.
Nice.
Nice. Is anyone else recording?
Oh, there's a little something. I don't know. We're not.
I'm going to cry.
Aww.
Yeah.
Oh, there she goes.
Are you making her cry, Vali?
No.
Doing a Cersei and twisting.
Oh, God.
Maybe say hi.
Baby fart, come on.
Just push on their tummy, that works sometimes.
Uh-oh. Oh, there she goes.
It's her podcast debut.
Baby's first podcast.
Keep it clean, everyone. Baby on board.
Yeah, she doesn't have headphones on, so she can't hear all the filthiness you guys are saying.
Good. I'll keep her in
now,
a baby, little
ear. You have to mute yourself when you're not speaking.
Oh, that's so adorable.
All right, enough of you. To your mom.
For the next 18 years.
Bye, yeah. Baby.
Bye, baby.
Baby Varley.